So today I'm welcoming onto Radio Gorgeous a best-selling number one author on Amazon, the fabulous Sue Moorcroft. Today we're talking about her must summer read set in the Alsace area of France, just for the holidays. Hi Sue, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi Josephine, thank you very much for inviting me on.
It's a pleasure. So let's talk about Leah Beaumont, who's the kind of lead character. I find it intriguing. She's a food scientist, loves baking, and is a petrol head who likes nothing more than relaxing watching Formula One. Isn't this a strange mixture in a person?
Well, I am an absolute Formula One nut. So from that aspect, I gave all that petrol headedness to Leah. That Formula One can only be listened to in silence and this, or watched in silence and this kind of thing. But no, I don't see, is it any more of an unusual mixture than an author who writes for women's magazines and women readers mainly to like Formula One? I don't know.
Okay, so why do you like Formula One? Is it from childhood? Is it from those heady days in the 70s when James Hunt and all the leggy blondes in the pit stop?
Well, I do remember that. Of course, we had an awful lot of deaths and everything then.
That was so exciting, though. Come on.
Oh, no. These are real people. I don't like to see anybody hurt at all. But it was actually 1994 I got interested. Graham Hill was actually well liked in my household. My parents always would switch him on if he was on a chat show or something. And I remember vividly the day he died, and they interrupted the news, and interrupted the programs to give us the news. And my parents both going, "Oh no!" And I was just watching. I was just cooking one Sunday lunchtime and had the TV on, and this race came on, and I heard them talking about Damon Hill. And being Graham Hill's little boy, and there wasn't anything more interesting to watch on. I think it was that or Country File or Little House on the Prairie or something. So it was before we could afford satellite TV. And I watched that race and I was just absolutely hooked. Damon did do very well in it. It was Hungary 1994. And I think I've probably only missed about one race per season since then. I watch them all and everything else to do with Formula One that I can. I've just come upstairs after watching the live drivers' conference.
I don't believe it.
No. I'm absolutely...
You really are obsessed. Have you met other women that are into it?
Hmm. All the time, yeah. I mean, well, there are women reporters, there are women in the paddock. It's just definitely not... It is male-dominated from the point of view of the physical strength that's needed to drive the cars.
Yeah, yeah. Are there any women drivers, or is it just impossible, like you say?
There has been at least one woman driver who has competed, but it was not at a time that I was following it, and I can't give you her name. There was one who was with Sauber, I think, as a third driver, and she never got her moment in the sun because she had an accident before she ever got a place in the race team, and sadly she died about a year after that. God. And then Susie Wolf, who is the she was the third driver for Williams for two or three seasons, I think. It's not that long since she stopped, but no, she never quite made it into the...
There are women out there doing it. That's really cool.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you ever go to Monte Carlo on it? You
know. No, although if you'd like to invite me, I'll go.
I think it's got to be one of your bucket list, Sue. I think you've got to get to one. I want to see you on screen, you know, waving.
Yeah, and wearing the team colours or something.
Exactly. Come on, you're dedicated. Yeah. If there's someone listening who can get Sue a ticket, please, contact Radio Gorgeous now.
I used to write a Formula One column for girlracer.co.uk.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I gave that up a couple of years ago because to a degree it was spoiling the races.
What, because you had to really study it?
Writing.
Yeah, instead of just enjoying it, like you say.
Exactly.
So now back to Leah. She wants to chill out this summer because she's kind of has a full-on job, and the opposite happens. Care of her sister, who's having a midlife crisis of her own and is having an affair.
Well, we don't immediately know that about her. What we know when we join her is that she's in a bad place, Michelle, the sister. She's asked her husband to leave and found out she's pregnant. Yeah. And so she says to Leah, will you come on holiday with us? Well, initially they think the husband isn't going. Will you come on holiday with me and the children, because you'll do all the outdoors stuff with them, and you don't mind driving on the other side of the road, and I hate it. And so Leah agrees to go, and then she gets a text from her sister saying, oh, now Alistair wants to come. He booked it, and it's a whole month in August, all of August we're supposed to be there, and he doesn't want to be away from the children for that long, and the children will hate me if I say no, so I'm going to say yes. And Leah says, oh, good, well, I won't come then. And she said, oh, no, please come, please come. I'll shoot myself if you don't come. I need you there. And so possibly at times during the summer, Leah thinks that Michelle shooting herself wouldn't have been a bad option. She'd gone for it. But although she is quite a feisty person, Leah, and she is husband-free and child-free by choice. And so to end up in a country where she doesn't speak the language, looking after her sister's children and her sister's husband is not exactly what she had in mind for her gardening leave between jobs.
Exactly. So so let's get to the love interest. He is gorgeous. Yeah. Irishman, Ronan.
Ronan Shea, yeah.
Oh, God. I could just, he looked to me just like kind of Piers Brosnan, but a bit ragged, a bit more ragged, you know, not so elegant, you know, a bit like, a bit more done in than him.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he's lived, hasn't he? But he's having a midlife crisis as well, because he's a glamorous helicopter pilot, but he's been grounded.
Well, he didn't mean to have a midlife crisis. It isn't his fault.
No.
He had what they call a hard landing, a forced landing, because when your helicopter, the engine goes off and you're in midair, you've got to do something. You can't just park it up there. And so he does know there's this thing called auto-rotation, which you'll have read about in the book. It's rather like a sycamore seed, you know, the way it comes down to ground on the breeze. If you just get your helicopter rotors at the right angle, you can sort of come down at an angle, and then when you get right near the floor, you flare, they call it, lift the nose up, and that puts the brakes on and run onto the ground. And everything, that's something helicopter pilots learn until they can do it in their sleep. But he couldn't tell that the ground was boggy. And so the helicopter flipped and he got a harness injury. He broke his clavicle. And that's how he ended up with the summer off. And he owns the house next door. It's his summer residence that was his mum and dad's, Shay Shay. And he...
Shay Shay, I love it.
Named hilariously by his parents, yeah. And so he kept it, and he's gone there for the summer with his son. He's not a single dad, but he's a separated or divorced dad, and he he shares the custody of his son.
Well, actually, my favourite people in the book includes the son, because they are the teenagers, because Michelle's got two children as well. You get their attitudes, grumbling, infighting and slang spot on, and I find them really amusing, actually. I find them they're the comic element, actually.
They are. They were great fun, especially with, I won't say it on air, but their pronunciation of things like shiitake, mushrooms and stuff like this. Yeah, I actually saw Curtis at McDonald's when my mum's still with us. Mm. I lost her last year. Oh, and when she was still with us, she loved to go to McDonald's. So I was there with her one Sunday lunchtime, and there was this young guy I was watching, and he probably was 15. I made him a bit younger to fit the timeline in just for the holidays. But he was a goth, but with a small G, because I think he was only playing at it. He didn't like go in for the whole almost semi-religious experience that some people do. He just dresses the part, basically. And
can you explain what the character?
Well,
he was
all chains and studs and boots up to his knees, these check trousers like a chef wears, and black Doc Martin lookalikes. What do they call them? Mock Martins, I think, up to his knees. And and his belt was three chains or a chain wound round him three times, and you know, his top, you could have put him out for recycling. He was just covered in studs. And he seemed to me, though, shy. These girls were looking at him, and he had red patches in his cheeks. And then this, he was very tall and thin, and this old lady, not my mum, it would have made a better story if it was, actually, but this old lady looked up at him and said, "Are you one of the fashionable children?" And these girls just fell about laughing, and he was mortified. He sort of mumbled something at her and left with his burger in his hand. Poor chap. It's not the cool image that he wanted.
Well, that's the thing about him. I don't want to talk too much to give a story away, but he is sweet underneath, obviously, isn't he? Because they all are, really, aren't they? Very much.
He is... Yeah. With the teenagers, I examined something that we all come across a lot now, the family dynamic, when the family shape changes because the parents divorce, and where that leaves the children and the different experiences they have. And I've got friends with children in that situation. And so I've got very big ears when it comes to research, and I sit there quietly and listen to what they say. And also, for instance, I've got a friend whose grandson is in that situation, so she always worries about him and if he's okay. And I did set really Curtis's home life, having his mum and dad live in one town and his school be in the middle, and so he can go home to whichever parent he is living with for that part of the week. I did take that from what she told me about her grandson's experiences.
Well, I think even though, as we know, divorce is terrible and a trauma, people are just so much more grown up about it now, but then they're not always grown up about it in this book. So at the beginning of the book, you say you wanted the location to be Vaudreuil. So why did you change to be Alsace? All I know about the Alsace is it's where Alsatian dogs come from and quiche Lorraine.
Well, that's right. Yeah, it was when I learnt about Alsace at school, it was actually called Alsace and Lorraine. And what we knew about it mainly was that it has changed between being German and French in its history. Yeah. And the Germans annexed it in World War II and then had to give it back. And actually, if you go there, it's a fascinating, beautiful place. But it does look quite, to me, it looks a lot like Germany.
Wow. Black and white sort of houses and things?
They're more brown and cream, but a lot of tall, half-timbered houses, yes.
Yeah.
Framed houses.
Kind of gothic-y, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yes, very much so. The cathedral in Strasbourg, just look it up after we finish speaking. Just Google it. It is gorgeous. But it is the most gothic building I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Took about 200 years to complete. It's a gorgeous region. Mm. And a friend of mine moved there. Her son lives just over the border in Germany. And when she was staying with him, they went to Strasbourg, and she was retiring, and she's a single woman, and she said, "I'm going to come and live here." And she did, and she made the, I hope it wasn't a mistake, but she said to me, amongst many people, very expansively, "Come and stay whenever you want." So I was just looking at hotels and motels and cottages and what have you in the Dordogne with an idea of going there. And I suddenly remembered Julie saying this to me. So I met a mutual friend who's closer to Julie than I am and said, "Do you think she meant it?" And she said, "Yeah, pretty sure so. She's very laid back." So I went and shared her little single person's apartment in a village called Ostwald, which is...
That's in the book, yeah.
Yeah, it's about 25 minutes, I think, from Strasbourg on the tram. So... really, Kirchenhofen is Ostwald, is the same place. I stole things from their village, I hope they don't mind, including the wildlife, the koipu, and the pizza machine. I've never seen a machine that dispensed pizza. I just thought it was a brilliant idea. So it was fantastic 4 days, and I packed a lot of research and a lot of experiences in, because Julie's a lot of fun. A lot of drink and a lot of food in, possibly unwisely. And she introduced me to a French, she introduced me to several French ladies, but the one in particular, Corinne, is an English teacher in a senior school, a technical senior school in nearby. And she advised me on some of the native, you know, things that she understood were wrong. He said, I look at it a little bit like somebody from Australia who'd never been to England or Wales might not really be able to distinguish the between England and Wales.
Yeah.
Yet to us, it's a massive difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rather the same. Alsace is...
Can you tell us a few things culturally that's different than France then?
Well, the names,
they sound much
more German.
Yeah, yeah.
And several times I used surnames and Corinne said, that's too French. That's West French. You know, that's Brittany. That's where you've been before.
Wow.
Like Leclerc and Lemaitre and stuff like that.
Yeah.
She said, that's not... They had much more German names, like Zuckerberg is an Alsatian name.
Yeah.
There are a lot of waterways, it seems to me.
Mm. I suppose because it's in near mountains then, so there's a lot of water coming down.
Not that I saw. No, it's more like Strasbourg has a big canal that meets up with the river and you go in lots of barges and bridges with flaps on and things like that.
Mm. I was going to say, do they speak like a dialect that's not French? Yeah.
Yes, Alsatian.
Mm.
So she spoke English, French and some Alsatian.
Yeah.
There were some people in the village who Alsatian was their first language and French was their second.
Yeah.
Much in the same way as there will be people in Wales that Gaelic is their first language rather than English, and so it's similar in lots of ways
like a sort of part of France which is very different culturally.
Yes.
So it's like Wales or Scotland, you know.
Yes,
for us.
yeah
so interesting. Do the people, are they more blondes there then?
I didn't notice that. No, I didn't notice that. That's a reasonable supposition, isn't it, being that close to northern Germany. No, I didn't notice that. I would not have known that I was in France, but I didn't feel that degree of difference that you might expect. No.
Now, I know you've just told us a lot about the research in the book, but what about the science? Because Leah's job, she's a chocolate scientist. How did you find out about this?
Well, I googled cool jobs and chocolate taster was number one. I'm a chocoholic, so I decided that would be an amazing job for her.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there was an awful lot online. I'm not the first person to have thought this is an interesting job. And so there are, if you go looking around YouTube and similar sites, you can find documentaries about people who are chocolate tasters.
Yes, because she it was like a wine tasting. She took it that seriously, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And how does it snap?
Yeah.
And what colour is it? And she talked about the people I researched. They talked about being able to see a brown rainbow on the surface of good quality chocolate. And so I had everybody in the book looking at it and looking at each other like, "What's she on? It's brown. Brown is brown." But I could understand, and when you snap it, there should be an edge on the chocolate. It shouldn't be sort of a dull.
I'm really into dark chocolate, and when I think about my kind of 80% Lindt bars, they're very sharp, actually.
Very dark and very good quality Lindt,
I like that bitter dark chocolate.
Yeah. So do I.
Oh, you do? So you're a dark fan. Yeah.
I am. The darker, the better, really. As long as it doesn't have coffee or Turkish delight in it, I will eat it.
Yeah, yeah. And what's your favourite kind of chocolate brand that we could sort of get our hands on?
Like... Oh, gosh, that's a bit like asking something about your favourite child, isn't it? I've got to say I'm a sucker for a Mars bar.
Yeah.
It's never changed. I do love just plain dark chocolate.
Bourneville.
Yeah. Bourneville.
Really?
I don't like
Bourneville. I find it
really?
Just no. I don't like Bourneville. I'm kind of Lindt.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Lindt. Really, is it or sort of handmade chocolates? I just don't really like. I don't even like Green and Blacks anymore.
Oh, well, I love Green and Black.
Yeah,
I've got to shout out for Thorntons. I'm related to the Thorntons.
Oh, God!
It's distant. But my second cousin, who is into genealogy, told me about this and sent me the family tree. And I think I'm correct in saying my great-grandmother was the first cousin of one of the Mrs. Thorntons, one of the early Mrs. Thorntons. So they were.
God, so this is where you get your chocolate drive from.
Must be. Must be. Unfortunately, it gives me migraines, so I can't indulge.
Oh, God. Oh, no. This is just terrible.
Well, I indulge a bit.
Yeah.
I
have, what, like I have, one cube or something?
Well, I'm not very good at the one cube thing. Once it's unwrapped, I eat the whole pack, even if it's a massive slab. No, I have two scoops of chocolate ice cream a day. That's my dessert. And I do allow myself to have something if I'm out for dinner, so a chocolate brownie or a chocolate mousse or something like that.
But how do you know that won't bring on the headache?
Well, I can have small amounts.
So what's the, tell us a lot, come on, tell us how much you have to eat to get the migraine. I'm dying to know.
Well, it depends, because my migraines, I don't know about everybody else's, are they're rather, it's a cumulative effect. Caffeine is a cumulative poison. Mm. And so it depends how many cups of tea I've had as well. I can't drink that much tea, and I drink decaf or Red Bush wherever possible, but the tannin affects me as well. But other things affect me. This morning, the utility room light went crackers before it went bang, and it flashed several times. Not just the flicker that those tube lights seem to, fluorescent lights they're called, aren't they, seem to specialise in, but it went on and off completely, very rapidly. And I couldn't get out of the room in time, and I felt really sick. I had to sit down. I had a white dot in my vision, then stayed with me for a couple of hours. So all kinds of things trigger it, and hormones trigger it as well. So I don't suffer as badly now as I did when I was in my 30s.
Fascinating.
That was the peak of it. So, you know, it depends. Mm. I will keep on having small amounts of both tea and chocolate until I feel ill. Then I'll stop for a bit.
It's like you're in tune now. You've learned how to manage it, it sounds like.
Yes, yeah. I was diagnosed in my early 30s. So, yeah, I've had a good old... and I'm not the only one. You know, lots of people in my family have migraines of one description or another.
That's
both my brothers...
That's so, really interesting.
Yeah,
so it literally is. Yeah, you literally, you know. Well, it could. Obviously, it's not from the Thornton side.
It can't be, can it? No, it can't be.
Okay, so we better wrap up now. But thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. I've just got one last question. Why should people go out and buy your book, Sue?
Well, it's very entertaining, but it will also give them food for thought. There are some quite deep themes in there.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. And for more delicious authors, go to radiogorgeous.com. Just for the Holidays by Sue Moorcroft is published by HarperCollins, radiogorgeous.com.